Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. A lot to get to, including in just a bit, the shutdown's over. But questions linger for SNAP and small businesses, and we'll take a look at the issue in our weekly podcast, Prairie Beat. And Valley City is bringing its World War II history to life in a modern, interactive way. We'll have that story a bit later, too.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All right, eat pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
This is another edition of Prairie Plates served weekly here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Rick Eon. Today we're going to talk Thanksgiving foods. We're going to talk turkey with a caterer and chef here in downtown Fargo, Christopher Dietz, who calls himself the bored foodie, but he's really not boring. Chris, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being in today. Talk about the name, the bored foodie, and people can find you on Facebook and on your website, but talk about the name a little bit.
Well, the name made a lot more sense when I just was a recipe blog, because I don't like boring food, so all of my recipes are supposed to be not boring, but then it just kind of carried over into catering.
And you have a lot of recipes on your website, and what website is that?
Yep, that's theboredfoodie.com.
And I noticed a lot of recipes on there. Maybe there's some Thanksgiving recipes on there too. But
I think I did like a Cajun turkey or something like that at one point.
I noticed you like a lot of spicy food.
I do.
There's a lot of Mexican food on there.
I like flavor, big flavors. High acid, not necessarily high salt, balanced salt, and a lot of spice. Just, I don't really like boring food, so.
And you were, a little bit about your background, you were a cook at Paradiso for a long time.
I was in high school up until I was 26, I think, and then quit everything related to food and became a handyman, and then got back into it with the food blog around COVID, and it became catering, so it's been good.
And your family has a little history with that restaurant as well.
Yeah, my uncle is the kitchen manager there. He's been there since they opened in 79 or 80. So he's been there forever.
I cooked at Green Mill and Outback Steakhouse back in kind of college age. So it's just fun to kind of talk about the background of folks and just, you know, it just brings a lot to the table. You learn a lot in a commercial kitchen.
Yep, I agree. You learn how to use the equipment and just how to cook in bulk.
Yeah, stay organized, mise en place, the system.
Yep.
There's, you know, you come in early in the morning, the prep cooks, and then it just kind of culminates in the evenings.
Yeah, there's no such thing as just a 5 to 7 dinner service. It's start at 5 or 6 in the morning, and then you can have dinner service at 5 p.m.
Yeah, these folks work really hard, and that's part of the point of having this show is just to make sure that people understand how hard people work in the service industry. And Chris is one of those guys. Well, let's talk turkey a little bit and get into Thanksgiving foods, because as we all know, that big holiday is coming up. And we've talked about cooking turkeys previously and deep fried, roasted, smoked. It sounds like you've done it all.
I have tried all of them. My favorite's always going to be deep fried, but it's also the most dangerous, and weather is so dependent on it.
Yeah, don't burn your house down cooking your turkey.
Yep, exactly. I like to watch Good Eats, Alton Brown.
Yeah.
He did like that turkey Derek thing. I've made that in the past, and it actually works really well.
And I think he cooked that in the backyard or in his driveway. Some people cook it in their garage. I get it when it's snowing, but
That is a fire waiting to happen. It is, yeah.
The turkey 911. Well, do you like to brine your turkey? Do you like to dry brine it?
I will always brine the turkey for at least 24 hours. And then in the brine, it's pretty basic brine. It's salt, brown sugar, bay leaf. I add apple cider vinegar and what is it, allspice, just to get a little bit more flavor, salt and pepper. And then after that, I'll take it out, pat it dry, and then I like to make a butter injection.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, injection, no injection?
If I have time to do it, I like the injection just because it adds more. I mean, turkey is pretty boring protein.
It can't be boring.
I agree. So it's you got to spice it up any way you can. So I'll do an injection, and then if I've done it before where I'll take, like, cut up a stick of butter and stick it under the skin on top of the injection, and then I make, like, a mesquite rub to go on the outside so that the skin gets a good flavor also.
Do you place an onion, carrot, celery, like a carrot, celery, and onion mix in the bird, or do you stuff it? Some people like to stuff it. I think it messes up cooking times when I like to make dressing separate.
I like to spatchcock it.
Yeah.
So there's no real opportunity to stuff it. I think it makes it the whole thing cook more evenly and faster.
A lot of chefs like to spatchcock their bird, and you can't have a huge bird unless you have like a huge oven if you're going to spatchcock it. But larger birds to me are a little more tough, I guess. You know, I like to stay around the 10 to 16 pound range, but walk folks through the spatchcocking process because it's violent.
It kind of is. So you got to cut the spine out of it, and then you take a knife and you score the breastbone, and then you just break the breastbone so that the whole bird is laying flat. And then it cuts the cooking time down by at least a third.
Yeah.
And it makes it so that you're not making your white meat super dry in order to get the dark meat cooked, because they have to be cooked at different temperatures. So it works really well for smoking, and it works really well if you're just cooking in the oven. The only time it doesn't work is if you're going to deep fry it, or if you're trying to make that like pretty presentation bird.
Right.
That's when you need to employ like the tin foil over the breast or do different basting techniques and stuff like that just to keep the breast moist.
And you probably would recommend a thermometer that's a decent thermometer, not that thing that pops out.
I remove that thing and throw it away immediately.
Yes, I do too.
Yep.
It's gone.
Probe thermometers are a lifesaver.
Yes, they are.
Almost everything I cook, you can kind of go by feel, not with poultry, but with a lot of things. I always temp it because it just eliminates any thought. You know what your temperature is supposed to be. Cook it to that temperature. It's perfect every time.
Yeah, I think with steaks by feel, if you can get that going. I love grilling on charcoal, and you get to a point where there's a feel for it. But, yeah, poultry, I think a probe thermometer is appropriate.
Right.
One of my favorite ways to cook a turkey is on a Weber kettle-style grill with charcoal. And the thing about that is it's the temperature is variable.
Mm-hmm.
And although those grills are enameled, if you're cooking, if it's cold on Thanksgiving, you're going to sit there for a little while longer.
Yeah, definitely weather plays into a big part of it around here.
It does.
I've done it like that. I think my favorite way, besides deep frying, is to put it on just some sort of a pellet smoker or something.
Sure.
And walk away, because it, like, that's essentially the same as cooking in an oven, but you get more flavor.
Well, that is making me hungry, and I'm looking forward to Thanksgiving, but let's talk a little bit more about other dishes for Thanksgiving. Mashed potatoes. Some people really whip their mashed potatoes in a mixer and they get gluey, and that's really not the route to go, in my opinion.
Yeah, thoughts they get really gummy when you do it that way, because it breaks down all of those starches. I like to steam them essentially and then run through a ricer. Nice thing about doing that is you don't necessarily have to peel the potato, because the ricer kind of removes the skin and it just makes a nice fluffy texture, so when you're mixing in your butter and your cream and milk and all of that stuff, it still stays light.
I do own a ricer as well, and that's a really good tool to have. And I usually boil the potatoes, but steaming them, that's a good tip, because then they're not full of liquid.
Right. Yep. That way you're reducing the amount of chance it's going to get gummy.
And there's more room to add like butter and cream.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
The good stuff.
Butter is everything, especially with holidays.
Yeah, it is. It truly is. Gravy, then. you know, people struggle with gravy, and I don't really understand why, but I have this separator thing that I use that separates the juice from the fat, and it has a hole in the bottom that you press a button. It's really slick.
Mm-hmm.
But any tips on making gravy?
When I make gravy, so because I like to spatchcock the turkey, I take like the spine and the neck and everything that comes in, all the stuff you throw away, throw it in an Instant Pot and cook that for a few hours, kind of like making my own turkey stock. And then I turn that into gravy. So then I'll make a roux, equal parts butter and flour, and add that to the turkey stock that I just made. And it gives it not necessarily a, I guess I think it gives it a better flavor because you're getting that like real turkey flavor, but it's also not going to be lumpy ever, because once you cook the roux into the turkey gravy, it's just smooth.
Well, the next thing on the list here is dressing. And one thing for me when I'm making dressing, I don't like to add too much liquid because if the dressing's soupy, it just kind of ruins it. I kind of like it a little dry so I can dump a bunch of gravy on it, actually.
Yes, I think that's kind of the purpose of it. It's just another way to get more gravy and more butter and more turkey, everything. It's more of like a vessel to get those.
A vessel, that's a good word.
But yeah, I agree. I don't like the idea of stuffing a bird, because that's going to, you have to pay way more attention to temperatures,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to get people sick.
That's another good point. Health. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. With poultry.
Yeah. Poultry, you really need to be careful, especially the cross contamination and everything, because even though your breast might be right temp, there's a good chance that stuffing isn't going to be the right temp. So you're going to have to overcook everything in order to get the stuffing to the right temp. So I'd rather do them in separate pans and take some of that turkey stock that I was talking about and add that to the stuffing.
Those are all very good suggestions. And for dressing, I usually have a mirepoix, you know, carrot, celery, onion. I do like to add either some breakfast sausage or sometimes hot Italian sausage.
I've tried those. I'd also have tried making like my own cornbread and adding that.
Mm, yes.
I've never really been a big fan of adding fruit of any kinds
no.
to them. I know a lot of people are into that, but that's not me.
Have you ever tried oysters? Some people like oysters.
I've never tried that.
Chicken livers or the turkey liver?
I've never tried it in it, but that's, again, I'll put that in the stock. So you're not actually eating it, but you're getting that flavor.
Well, the next thing on the list is cranberry sauce. And for me, I like to buy whole cranberries and kind of stew them down in orange juice and add sugar and that sort of thing, maybe a cinnamon stick. Any tips on cranberry sauce? I do like the canned variety, by the way.
There's nothing wrong with the canned variety. When I've made cranberry sauce, I do agree with you, orange juice. I usually add some sort of like a lighter wine, like a white wine, like a Sauvignon Blanc or something along those lines, just to get the acid up. And then, yeah, it's the same thing. It's the standard stuff. Add a little bit extra sugar, but then I will also add like some chipotle powder or ground up chipotle and adobo sauce, because I like to add some sort of a flair to everything.
Not boring.
Exactly.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about green bean casserole, and you had some suggestions for improvements over the normal variety.
Well, what I would do, I don't think I've ever actually made it, but if I was to make it, I would take the cream of mushroom soup and eliminate that, because that's just a salt bomb, and make my own version of it, either a cream of onion or cream of chicken or something like that. And then mix it into the green beans and use fresh green beans like you talked about off the air.
Yeah, no canned green beans.
Yeah. My son would disagree with you. He's obsessed with canned green beans for some reason. It's his favorite part of school lunch.
Hmm.
But yeah, I agree. If you're going to do it, you should do it to where you want to taste every ingredient and then it comes together.
Are there any non-boring Thanksgiving foods that you really like to make? Something special.
Thanksgiving, my family's always been pretty generic, but my dad a few years ago got really into making like empanadas and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
So that has kind of become more of a family tradition. And then, I mean, I think Thanksgiving is about comfort food, so nothing too crazy, but the next day, the leftovers turning like the dressing into a waffle and then putting the turkey and gravy and everything on top of that. That's more of like what I like to do.
Well, to me, Thanksgiving is about family, friends, and just getting together and talking, probably staying away from politics.
Yeah, politics is a good one to avoid.
Stick with football.
Yeah, although football can get contentious.
It can. You're a Cowboys fan.
I am. It's America's team.
Okay. Well, the Vikings aren't doing so well this year, so I may switch to a different team. But
I wouldn't recommend the Cowboys. They're pretty bad this year.
Well, Chris Dietz, the board foodie, thanks for coming in this week for Prairie Plates. It was a pleasure. Thanks for all the Thanksgiving food tips. We really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, anytime. This was fun.
Fargo-Moorhead Opera presents Amal and the Night Visitors, the story of a boy, his mother, and three kings. Performances are November 21st and 22nd at 6:30 p.m. and November 23rd at 2 p.m. at the MCOM Center. Details at fmopera.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Now that the government shutdown has ended, what happens to North Dakotans who had lost their SNAP benefits or had them reduced? In this episode of our weekly regional news podcast, Prairie Beat, we'll also venture across the Red River to Moorhead to find out why a provision in the bill that just passed Congress has one local brewery worried.
We were seeing an increased need before the government shut down, and we know that these families are still going to be feeling the strain with their SNAP benefits back and checks fully paid.
Howdy, hey, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back to Prairie Beat.
Indeed, we are back after taking last week off. Danielle had to take a couple of personal days going down the rabbit hole. That was the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, a Gen Z TikTok sensation, according to NPR.
You know, I did take a couple of days off. I didn't have childcare, but, you know, while I was with my kids, I was enjoying a lot of the Fitzgerald-related content.
Yeah, and speaking of TikTok and social media, I hear that today is National Men's Day, according to you and your
International
feed.
Men's Day, so and worldwide, and World Toilet Day,
what the
FYI.
Heck does that say? What does that
well,
say
Well, listen,
about
Toilet
Men's
Day,
Day
Toilet Day, it's a big day for plumbing and sanitation. I mean, it's an important, meaningful day.
I've been flushed from the bathroom of your heart.
Yeah, well, okay, from shipwrecks to train wrecks, that was 43 days. The federal government was closed. And during that time, Danielle, you were following pretty closely everything mm-hmm. that was happening. And it was a lot. Federal workers being fired or workers going without pay. Republicans and Democrats refused to come to an agreement on the Affordable Care Act subsidies. And so ultimately, a handful of Democrats relented, much to the chagrin of many other Democrats, mm-hmm. and they joined Republicans to open the government. But a very major thing that happened during the shutdown that had real on the ground and immediate impacts nationwide was when payments to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, did not go out to beneficiaries.
That's correct. And so, yes, November 1st came and the benefits did not. It's about 57,000 people in North Dakota who utilize that program. And a lot of what goes out depends on different, you know, several different factors. On average, this is about, you know, I've seen anywhere from $175 to $200, maybe $250 a month per person on this program. And that is pretty significant when folks who are depending on it don't get it.
Yeah, you think about 57,000, that would be like the population of Grand Forks mm-hmm. basically is relying on these benefits. I will say it has been pretty impactful to see the state and communities here really step up the plate. North Dakotans did not want to see their neighbors go hungry.
Yeah, that happened immediately. Right before that November 1st date, Governor Armstrong got out in front and basically, here's the Cliff Notes version here. He worked with state agencies to deliver a portion of benefits to folks. And they also partnered with Great Plains Food Bank. They gave them some money. And the food bank has been really working hard as well to meet that need. I talked with Darby Ness. She's the media relations person at the food bank late last week about this. She says, you know, need has been very high for a while. Last year, they were serving 1 in 5 North Dakotans and 1 in 4 children. And during the shutdown, the pressure only compounded. She says the effects are not going to go away overnight.
We're anticipating to distribute about 3.5 million pounds over the month of November and December alone. And kind of put that in perspective, we typically distribute just over 1 million pounds a month. So what we're planning for the current month of November and the rest of December is about a 60% increase of the amount of food we need to continue to meet the need.
Yeah, you know, I really do believe that. I did read recently that while it's great the benefits are returning, folks may have had to use the money they would otherwise have spent on food on other things like rent, utilities, and other bills, that terrible calculus one has to make sometimes. And so it will be a bit of time here before people are really able to catch up on that.
There absolutely will be some economic ripples that take a while to recover from after the shutdown.
We were just in Williston again in November, and we served 279 households, which is a 60% increase from our October mobile that we held out there. And so we're seeing this across our partner network. We're seeing an increase for food needs at our partner pantries.
Cost of living gets so high, rich and poor, they start to cry.
Now, while the economy tries to get back up after all of that, meanwhile, there was a bit of a surprise in the funding bill that ultimately passed Congress and was signed by the president to reopen the government. And this may also have a bit of economic consequence for another specific corner of the economy.
I've been talking to a number of other people in the industry lately who are very freaked out about this, because I think there's some real concern that this will put a lot of businesses out of business.
So that is Aaron Junkie, and he is owner and president of Junkyard Brewing Company. They have a couple of spots in the FM metro area. One tap room is in West Fargo, but at their original location in Moorhead, since the legalization of cannabis in Minnesota, they started offering THC-infused beverages. And this is an item that really took off in legalized states after COVID. I'll do my best to just briefly explain this here. In the 2018 Farm Bill, there was a loophole that, or kind of like an exemption, it allowed legal extraction of THC from the hemp plant. And as states were making their own moves to legalize THC in their own ways, companies were figuring out how to make products with hemp and THC. Like, there's, you can get lotions, balms, edibles, vapes, and breweries saw an opportunity because during the pandemic, craft beer consumption went down. So they started filling that void with THC-infused drinks, and they're really popular. And this funding bill contained a provision that basically closes that loophole and will effectively ban all hemp-derived THC products. Poof. And Aaron Junkie says lots of breweries in Minnesota have made these beverages a substantial part of their business.
We're a much smaller brewery that's a lot more taproom-based, so I'm not as freaked out as some of the bigger production breweries. However, I think it will really, really hurt us to lose that revenue.
Okay, and if you're wondering where Junkyard Brewery got its name, now you know. Aaron Junkie.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is pretty big news. Billions of dollars. They say hundreds of thousands of jobs. A popular local business right in our own backyard that will be impacted. So got to wonder what happens next.
The industry has a year before the provision will take effect and the loophole will officially close.
It's kind of cloudy, smoky, if you will. The all-important economy keeps making headlines here at Prairie Public. Danielle, what else have you, Dave, and Todd been working on this week?
If we do it all together, think of the support that you'll have around the country.
The Great American Smokeout is this week. It's a national public health initiative to encourage people to quit using tobacco products.
Of course, it's just this one very unique experience opportunity for us to kind of go home.
NDSU President Dr. David Cook is leaving to become president at Iowa State University in Ames.
The 40-pound Tom Rubin. Great timing, Reuben.
And of course, one lucky turkey was pardoned at the state capitol in Bismarck. It's a ceremonial thing that happens every year before Thanksgiving.
Once again, thanks for all that, Danielle, for staying on top of all the news that is happening here in North Dakota and around the region.
Absolutely. Be sure to tune into Prairie Public for more regional news or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right. Thank you for joining us on Prairie Beat today. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That's this week's Prairie Beat. You can subscribe to our weekly news podcast wherever you get your favorites. Still to come on Main Street, Valley City. It's bringing its World War II history
to life, and you can get a preview tomorrow night. That's ahead on Main Street. Stay with us. Main Street continues today by turning to Valley City, a community preserving its past in a very modern way. The Barnes County Museum is celebrating its designation as a World War II Heritage City with a special open house tomorrow. Guests will get a first look at interpretive panels that will soon appear across the community from the Cheyenne Byway to Medicine Wheel Park and through a partnership with Talking Trail. Visitors will soon be able to hear these local war stories narrated by experts and even drawn from eyewitnesses' oral histories. It's a powerful way to connect generations to the service and sacrifice of North Dakotans in the World War II era. And today we are joined by Project Coordinator Mary Lee Nielsen. Mary Lee, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you for having me, Craig.
What a wonderful, wonderful project. And if you could maybe start us with a big picture. What's it mean for Valley City to be designated a World War II Heritage City, and how did that recognition come about?
You know, it is a big deal for our town to be recognized because our Barnes County Museum is excellent, and they're the ones that put together the whole designation form and that type of thing, and it fits so well in because we have so many locals that were so involved with the effort. I have learned so much from doing this project. And because we have 8 panels around Valley City, and we have 10 panels within the museum because we didn't have enough room for everything. And so we expanded. And it's one of 3 national designations Valley City has.
What will people see and experience when they come to the open house tomorrow night?
Well, we're giving the sneak peek of all our panels are going to be in one spot because we haven't put them out in this. And so we'll just put them all together and let people see all the panels together. And so, yeah, it's going to be one easy way to see it all.
Can you give us an idea of the real stories that you're hoping to tell?
Oh, you know, there's so many stories. Every panel has a story. I mean, down at Valley City State University, we had the B-12 program training naval officers all the way through. And so what the college did with Navy guys, we were training leaders. So that's, you know, down there. Of course, we have our Company G in Valley City, which was the first one to go from North Dakota in World War II. And so we have their story. And then we have the battalion's 188th battalion. And we have a bunch of big stories, too. And they went through all through Europe on the whole trail to bring people. And so we have kind of stories on that one. And the hometown stories. We got chosen because of our hometown work. And the little things that we did at home, too, were so important. We had, you know, like many places had victory gardens, you know, to help raise food. We have the 4th largest mill in the United States at that time that was refigured to make granules for ammunition. You know, so they retrofitted the whole plant to do that. We had a doctor and his wife here that worked on the Manhattan Project. We're big parts of the Manhattan Project. We had another guy from the area that was part of the making of the Ghost Army. The Ghost Army, I mean, I'm not an expert on any of this, so please take that in mind as we talk about all these things. But the Ghost Army was just so appealing to me because it was all about faking people out. And so they actually they didn't have enough tanks and everything in some areas. And so they got the idea of putting coverings over pickups or Jeeps and to make them look like tanks. And so they set them out outside of town, then they'd send actors into town to start talking up about this big army that, you know, this big battalion that was coming in. you know, talking up something that wasn't even real. But evidently they convinced enough people because it worked more than one area. And so they actually used, you know, like I said, actors, but they also had the sound effects of actual tanks and that type of thing. And so they had the sounds outside of town. And so people believed this whole thing. Patton actually used them in one of his big pushes too. So, I mean, it's just, I didn't know that story at all. So it was amazing to me what we did.
Where would you place the interpretive panels? Was it hard to figure out where you wanted them to be so that they would be seen, et cetera?
Actually, you know, it was easy because we took them to the places that did it. Right on Valley City State Campus, we have a panel right by the B-12 anchor that they had commemorating the program. And so we pulled the story even greater than having an anchor sitting there. And so that type of thing. We had the old armory in Valley City. It's now the rec center. But that's where the battalion and Company G went out of. And so we have pictures of them on the steps. So yeah, it goes. So the panels go right there. We had nuns from Valley City that went back to their home organization in France to visit. And at that time, the Germans came in and captured them. And so we had four of our nuns that were captured. And we have the story of that at St. Catherine's, the church area. And so it was just very natural settings. Mercy Hospital did a nurses training program. So right outside the hospital, we have a panel.
What a wonderful, wonderful way to preserve local history, Mary Lee. So congratulations for that. I'm curious about the Talking Trail app. Can you tell me about that and how will it enhance what people learn from the panels?
Well, you know, we started looking at the panels. We thought, there's way too much information for just these panels. Let's give them some more stories. And so the wonderful part is that Wes and his crew down at the museum have interviewed people from the past. And so we'll have actual talking points from the people that lived there in many cases. And, you know, in Valley City, like I mentioned, that we have other things going on here. And so our talking trail encompasses not only the heritage trail, but we have a bridge tour and we have Medicine Wheel Park trail. And so we put all of that into a talking trail. So we made it one big package.
People will be able to download that on wherever they get their apps for their phone?
Correct. You know, you'll have the QR codes and you'll have the phone numbers. You'll have all those things on it to get the talking trail. So we're just in the midst of developing that. So I'm learning more stories as we go.
It's wonderful news to me that the trail launches and all of this coincides with the 250th anniversary of the United States. What significance are you tying to this project and that milestone, Mary Lee?
Well, you know, the trail and everything with the talking trail and everything won't be all together till next year. So our huge grand opening is going to coincide with the celebration. And so I just feel it's also patriotic, you know?
So that'll be on the 4th of July?
Actually, not right on the 4th, because we want people here from the National Park Service and the state tourism and all the different people that have helped us. And doing it right on the 4th doesn't work. So we haven't set the date there.
Enjoying my conversation with Mary Lee Nielsen. She's a project coordinator for Valley City and its World War II Heritage City designation. And they have an open house. And that's tomorrow, November 20th, from 5 to 8:30 at the Barnes County Museum. And it's open to everyone. There'll also be a special lecture at 7 o'clock on local wartime contributions. It'll be a wonderful event to attend. All right.
And if you get there, I think we're going to have a World War II Jeep right in front of the museum, so you'll know where to come.
For folks that don't know, North Dakota's oldest county museum is that museum. And how does that legacy kind of shape the way you think about preserving history and you want to present World War II and its history?
You know, we have such outstanding people at that museum. Wes Anderson is a wonderful curator. He has turned that museum into, like you said, a destination in Valley City. you know, with all his work. And so, yeah, it was a natural for them to actually go after this designation, because they already had a bunch of displays and all different things set up for World War II already. So now we're just putting them together, and we've gotten grants to fix up a portion of the museum. And so it's all coming together.
What are you hoping that two segments here? First, okay. Residents of Valley City take away from what they're going to experience as the year develops, and then also tourists who come to the community. Let's talk about residents first.
Okay. So they start seeing all these stories. There are so many things that we can be proud of in Valley City with our history. Our company, G, telling their story is huge. We had the home front, the guard. We had our own guard here, that just 40 soldiers that were guarding the Highline Bridge during this time. And most people have no idea about that story. We're a little bit wondering how much we should tell about where those sniper nests were, because I'm sure Burlington, Northern Santa Fe doesn't want people all over their land looking for sniper nests.
And how about tourists? What are you hoping that they take away when they see this for the first time?
You know, a lot of people, I don't think know enough about World War II. And so I hope they get a general picture of what a small town did to make a difference in war. And as they come into Valley City, they're going to be surprised to see not only the World War II Heritage Trail, but the bridge tour that we have, with Medicine Woe Park. And the museum is not just a World War II museum. It's got so many other stories in it that it tells the story of North Dakota, not just Valley City.
This will have legs. This will not just be on display for a year. So what's your long-term vision for the project after the big celebration in 2026?
That's a good question, Craig. Thinking beyond, you know, what is our next thing? Are we going to, I think when we find more stories, we're going to have to do more things, you know, to start getting those stories out there too. I think we're kind of the tip of the iceberg on some of the things we were doing.
Who's been involved in the development of what folks are going to see? Because it's just not a solo effort here.
No, of course not. The whole board at the museum, Dr. Steve King and his whole group, you know, are behind this whole thing, putting things together. We have a grant writer in Valley City through the Economic Development Corporation, Trinity Nelson, that was huge in helping us write the grant also. And actually the putting things together, of course, Wes is our backbone on everything, you know, because go to West, you need to find something. But
I've actually learned that to be true when it comes to Valley City, Mary Lee, but continue on.
Sandy Hansen, our graphic artist, is outstanding. She's done the panels. We will all work together looking at them, but she was the one that did it all, really, the panel parts. I mean, I can't give her enough. She's a retired person that came back to work for us. And she's on the board, and so she knows the museum. And I had worked on the byway before putting panels together. I was a marketing coordinator for the byway, so I had a little background in setting those kind of things up. And so working with her to put those panels together, these panels are a little different than like a byway panel, because we know history people want more information. You know, on the byway panel, we said you can get it done in 3 minutes. No way are you going to get our panels done on the World War II Heritage Trail done in 3 minutes. No way. Because there's good information, on all of them. So she put them together. And then we have Louis Leggy on the board that is a retired construction person. He can do anything. And so he's been installing and putting in the concrete, you know, pads and all the kind of things, and deciding how we're going to hook up the talking trail signs to the interpretive panels. It takes so many people to do these things, but if you come in the Valley City, you're going to see a huge mural up by the museum. It's on the Central Avenue Pharmacy building next door, but they allowed us to put this huge mural by the museum. And Bill Cochran is a local artist who has helped out at the Barnes County Museum on so many things. He did the mural. He designed the t-shirts that we have for it. And so, yeah, it's been a combination. It's been fun with me working with the board, because they pretty much allowed me free reign to do some dreaming and working with the board. Stacy Inkstead from the board is working with me. We're going to put together a whole presentation on the ceiling in the area, you know, so there's going to be a lot of quirky little things too.
When I think of presentations like this, Mary Lee, I kind of think about students, about fourth graders, third graders, seventh graders. How do you hope this impacts them? This is a time, of course, in our history that is so long ago, not taught in schools like it used to be. Have you thought about the young kids that are going to be able to see the panels and think about those things?
Oh, very much so. Because we have the bridge panels in Valley City that talk about our history of Valley City a lot too. I know a lot of our teachers have already used those bridge panels as a way to get outside, number one, and learn about the city and North Dakota history. I mean, I'm down at the visitor center right here right now, and we talk about North Dakota history with the Rosebud Rail Car, with the development of the railroad and the development of the Cheyenne Valley. So we have worked with kids all the way through on all of our projects. And so that's why we're, you know, pushing the little ones. I've been telling kids about the Ghost Army, you know, just fun little stories to get them excited about some history.
You've had some challenges, I'm guessing, in creating the panels, in contemplating the interactive trail. Mm-hmm. What were they and what have you learned?
You know, because I've done the byway and I'm working on a water trail in Valley City too. We really haven't had too many challenges. We haven't been able to overcome. Our biggest challenge was, how do you decide which stories put on and which stories, you know, like what are our priorities? We had to prioritize a lot. That's probably a good way to put it. But the challenge is, you know, getting the grants. People have been so glad on the grants. You know, our city believed in us big time. The food and beverage grant we got from the city of Valley City, you know, they pretty much said, what do you need? You know, we had to write it all out, but what do you need? The same way we just got the Talking Trails grant from North Dakota Department of Commerce Tourism Division. You know, the same thing there. I mean, everything that we asked for, they said, go for it. You know, people are really believed in this from the beginning. So it has just made it easier to do it. And it hasn't been a challenge to get any of the spots for it. Everyone we went and talked to said, yes, we'd love to help preserve history. And so, yeah, this one hasn't had as many challenges as, say, a water trail.
Yeah. Also, it's certainly a wonderful effort. Mary Lee, for those who can't come to the open house tomorrow night, how can they follow the project or maybe even still participate relative to the planning of the launches in 2026?
If you can't come tomorrow night, this display will be set up for till we this spring when we start taking it apart and fix everything up. And so you can do that in the website, the Barnes County, just Google Barnes County Museum, and you'll get to the updated website. We just got a new update on the website. And so you can keep track of things there. And if you look at Valley City Tourism, you can keep up with there. The plot does a good job on all that stuff. So many different ways, and always the museum. It's wonderful.
My guest has been Mary Lee Nielsen. She's a project coordinator for Valley City's effort to become a World War II Heritage City designee, and they have certainly accomplished that. They have a lot that they will be bringing to us, all of us here in North Dakota, in 2026. They'll have an open house at the Barnes County Museum tomorrow night from 5 to 8:30 p.m. with a special World War II lecture at 7. And then they'll talk about the first interpretive sign installations that will go up next spring, just ahead of America's 250th celebration. 250-year celebration. 250 years, Mary Lee.
I know. I'm just so glad this is part of it. It's worked out. The timing is great.
Congratulations on your work, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 19th. November 19th marks the annual Lydia Pinkham Open Studios event in Lynn, Massachusetts, showcasing artists at the historic factory where Lydia's famous vegetable compound for women was manufactured. Patented in 1875, the popular elixir contained a small mix of roots and herbs, but its active ingredient was 18% alcohol. Women's health care was quite primitive at the time, but Lydia offered 40-proof relief. Testimonial ads filled newspapers nationwide, with women describing dramatic, life-changing results. During the Prohibition, men liked Lydia too. Lydia the Pink became a popular drinking song, humorously spoofing the problems of those who ingested Lydia Pinkham's elixir and their surprising transformations. Lydia died in 1882, but women continued to write to her. Her heirs ran the factory, published testimonials, and adjusted the ingredients over time. What does Lydia Pinkham have to do with the Turtle Mountain Reservation? A little momentary relief for industrious but impoverished residents. The high bush cranberry grows abundantly there and provides cramp bark used to ease female ailments. Men, women, and children collected and peeled the bark for Lydia Pinkham buyers. Gunny sacks of bark were taken to the big store in Belcourt. The berries had long been important in the fur trade, mixed with bison meat and fat to make pemmican, or turu, which could be stored indefinitely. The place name Pembina refers to the high bush cranberry. The Pembina Band of Chippewa played a key role in the Red River fur trade, and many later settled at Turtle Mountain. In the 1940s, tribal council leader Lewis Marion established a cranberry bark and oak post industry. Bark was neatly stacked in pyramids outside the big store, and both the tribe and its citizens profited from the contracts. Collected in winter, the outer layer of the bark peeled off easily. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's Layla Faldin. Look, I won't say that listening to Morning Edition makes you cool. I mean, I think that. But you might learn something that does.
One of the latest fitness fads involves wearing a weighted vest as you walk around.
Ed Sheeran has a new album that's bursting with international flavor.
The American Association of Orthodontists declared that braces have never been cooler.
Stay in the know with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll sit down with North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge to dig into the showdown over the North Dakota Ethics Commission. Why is Governor Kelly Armstrong pushing for a reset? What's at stake? And how do campaign finance advisory opinions fit into the fight? It's a closer look at who really polices ethics in Bismarck. That's tomorrow on Main Street at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.